Okay, it's 8:31. Rabbi Kelman's not here tonight to introduce it's on me. So let me just say, I hope you all had a very good Yom Tov, and I want to get right into our classes that I look forward to very much. Number 22, I think. Let me first respond to a couple things. Eric asked me a few weeks ago, so let me just spend a few minutes on this top, the issue of intermarriage, because that was, we saw at one of the conferences, they at least put out there that if this was allowed to raise the children Jewish, which wasn't allowed, that intermarriage would be permissible with a monotheist partner. And then, as we know, in later generations, the Reform movement permitted it. So what is the prohibition on intermarriage? Eric said, well, aren't there places in the Talmud where it seems to be only a rabbinic prohibition? He called attention to Gemara and Avodah Zarah. There's also one in Sanhedrin that speaks about decrees against sexual relations with non-Jews. So let me tell you. It's not for me to go through in great detail. You can all see in Rabbi Bleich's book, Contemporary Halachic Problems, Volume 2. But let me just give a quick summary, because it is interesting that what we regard as the absolute worst thing, because obviously it's the end of Jewish continuity, there are other things that technically could be seen as worse. So much so that you actually have had people, not just people, rabbis, who said things that... if you have, for instance, Jews who are not religious, you shouldn't make a shidduch with them because they're not going to be concerned with Taras Mishpacha. Let them marry non-Jews. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said that this shows a complete lack of Das Torah. That is a lack of understanding that you take the small area, the prohibition, but you're not seeing the larger picture here, not to mention the fact that most of these people don't know anything anyway, so it's not their fault. But I guess that would be halachocentric, to use Heschel's expression, when you're concerned about the nitty-gritty, but not about the larger picture that someone's going to marry a non-Jew, and that's the end of Judaism, end of any connection whatsoever. But if you look in Rabbi Bleich's book, beginning on 270, he does mention that in Avodah Zarah 36b, it's actually a machlokas. What is intermarriage? It's clearly it's Torah prohibition, the seven nations that lived in the land of Canaan before the Jews arrived, before the Israelites arrived. But what about other people, other non-Jews? According to the sages, marriage with members of other Gentile nations is forbidden only by virtue of rabbinic decree. And Rav Shimon bar Yochai holds no, that it's also a Torah prohibition. And he cites a proof for this. The Rambam rules in accordance with Rav Shimon bar Yochai. However, Rabbi Bleich has to acknowledge that the Tor holds not in accordance with Rav Shimon bar Yochai. So according to the Tor, and there's others as well, intermarriage is only a rabbinic prohibition. Incredible, you might say, but that's what he holds. Now, Rabbi Bleich says, nevertheless, after quoting the Tor, the severity of the stricture against intermarriage tends to indicate that even according to the Tor, some form of biblical prohibition against intermarriage with non-Jews who are not members of the seven nations must exist. The question to be resolved is the nature of the biblical prohibition. Now, the Tor doesn't say that. Rabbi Bleich says that since intermarriage is so bad, it must be that the Torah holds that it's an actual Torah prohibition. Well, I don't know. Had the Torah thought that, he had plenty of places to actually say that. Instead, all he says is that only with the members of the seven nations is there a prohibition, a biblical prohibition. Now, there's other prohibitions, perhaps fornication, things like that, but that's not the prohibition of that we usually think of in terms of intermarriage. And he cites numerous examples, tries to find, so for example, the prophet Malachi clearly speaks against intermarriage, and he's before the rabbis. So that would be a good proof, perhaps. You can see what he mentions. Now, as for what Rabbi speaks about later, now, as for the rabbinic edict that you find in two places, Sanhedrin and Avodah Zarah, that Eric is referring to fornication. That's not, that's something else. That's not referring to intermarriage. In fact, the Rambam, I found today, I was looking at it, the Rambam, his language is strange, because here, look at the Rambam in Ishus, chapter 1, Halacha Dalet. He says that before the Torah was given, a man could meet a woman in the marketplace and he could have relations. Then he says, after the Torah is given, that's forbidden because of the pasuk, there shall not be a harlot among the children of Israel. But then it says, "Lefichach kol abel alisha l'shem zinus b'lo kiddushim lo kamina Torah." He says anyone who has relations with a woman, he doesn't say a Jewish woman here, although that's the implication. I think it's obvious. So that there you can, anyone who wants more interest in it, as I said, you can look at Rabbi Blythe. I want to also, Daniel asked a good question, which I want to get back to this briefly. Remember Geiger's great novelty, his chidush, figuring something out that no one understood, that the orders of the tractates are in descending form. So here, for example, let's go through it, because it's easier to see it. Here's Taurus. They have this on Wikipedia. So look, you start with Kalim with 30, and it goes down the list. Olos, Nagoyim, Hara, Taurus. It's perfect. Then you go to the next thing, Kodshim. You see it goes down. Bit of a problem with Tamid. Tamid is 7. So people have said that this is a mistake in organization, that Tamid should be 4 Krisos. Kritot, Krisos. Then you go to Nezikin. So Nezikin, as we saw, the 3 Bavas were originally 1. Then you have Sanhedrin, and then you have Makos. What's Makos doing there? 3. Well, this can easily be explained. According, if you look in the introduction of the Rambam to the Mishnah, he says that there are those. Hold on a second. He says that in some editions, Makos is 1 unit with Sanhedrin. So originally, although the Rambam says that that's a mistake, it shouldn't be, but it's clear that that it was 1, that Sanhedrin and Makos were 1. So you keep Sanhedrin and Makos 1, and you look down. Again, it's descending. Now let's go to Nashim. Same thing. Yevamos, Ketubos, Kesubos, Nedarim, etc. The problem is when you get, then Shabbos. Shabbos is perfect as well. Look at the descending order. The problem is when you get to Zeroyim. And that's what Daniel asked me about. Zeraim is mixed up. That there are certain editions of the Talmud, which the first 3, which you'd have different divisions. And you'd have Brachos Pei Adamai, as I recall, as 3 separate. And then with the beginning on Kilayim, there was organized differently. It's obvious in the way we have it that it's not organized what seems to be the original way, that it had been turned around. But there's no doubt all scholars today are in agreement that Geiger's explanation is correct, and it could be that over time some of the Masechtas were changed. Now, since I the order, since I'm on this topic here, one of you asked me, I said that we were speaking about Yeshivish pronunciation and Horayot, and I said it's Yeshivish pronunciation is Horios. So one of you said that, well, how do I know that that's the Yeshivish pronunciation? Maybe that is the actual pronunciation. Because after all, Horios is spelled with a yud. But the truth is that you can't say this at all, because there's no word Horios with a cheruk under the resh. The word is Horayot. And it's the plural of Horaya, or from the Kal, Yud Resh Hey. The better question is, why as a singular do we say Hora, do we not say Horaya? We say Hora'a with an Aleph. So you would have expected the plural to be Hora'ot, not Horayot. And the answer for that is simply that in Rabbinic Hebrew, Yud and Aleph are often interchangeable. A good example of this is in the Rambam, not always, but often, he uses, the Rambam uses the word, now here it is, in Tesvav, but it's all throughout the Mishnah Torah. This is Perek Beis, Ibn Chalitza. It says, Yevama Shanadra Hanaya. We would today say Hana'ah with an Aleph. But in Rabbinic Hebrew, the Yud and the Aleph are interchangeable. We have other examples. What do we say, for example, we Rabbinic Hebrew to say to find something. They often say Matsinu. Why with a Yud? The singular is Matzah. It should be Matsanu. And I think in modern Hebrew, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think in modern Hebrew, you'd only say Matsanu. But in Rabbinic Hebrew, you often have Matsinu. Or, for example, with this word Matzah again, in Rabbinic Hebrew, they will say Mitsuyim, are found. Why Mitsuyim? It should be Mitsuim with an Aleph. But that's Rabbinic Hebrew. And the last thing I want to mention, let me put this over here, is one of you were kind enough to call my attention to, I had it, but I hadn't seen this article. Let me stop the share yet. In the latest tradition, I didn't have a subscription for many, many years. And I finally decided to get a subscription again because the new editors have made it really a good journal. And in fact, if you look at not this one, but the previous one, it's hard. It comes out 4 times a year. I don't know how you do good scholarship 4 times a year, but the previous issue, I have a short essay, the first time in like 23 years. I'm even looking right now at the picture of someone who is one of the editors on the editorial committee, I should say, I think for many years. And I can say that it's really, after going through difficult times, let's put it that way, this new editor has really turned it into a wonderful, wonderful journal. And partly because I think the competition of Chakira, to be a good journal, you need to take risks. You need to publish out of the box, interesting things. And he really has done it. This is Jeffrey Sachs, who happens to be an Agnon expert, if anyone's interested in Agnon. But Michael Harris, Rabbi Michael Harris from London, he has an article called Resultant Moral Luck in Jewish Tradition. And on page 7, he talks about this issue we've spoken about many times, the idea that this heretical theory I have that perhaps the Talmud was really supposed to not be for the masses, but was a closed book designed, written by rabbis for other rabbis. For those who haven't heard me say it, I know it's heretical. I know goes against the whole idea of Daf Yomi, but I've offered certain proofs. And here's another one. It's this is a story in Kiddushin where it tells about Rabbi Barashi, one of the Amorai, how his wife adorned herself and he would not fulfill the mitzvah that he's supposed to of relations with his wife. And she walked in front of him. He didn't recognize her and said, who are you? She says, I'm a prostitute. And lo and behold, he says, okay, let's get it on. And now this is about one of the Amorim. And this isn't, and it talks about this, about Rabbi Chiya. And the more, and what the story, the point of this for Rabbi Harris is he's dealing with the question. Let's say you do an action which you think is wrong, you think is sinful, but in the end, it's not sinful. You know, what do you make of this? This reminds me of Alan Dershowitz in his book, The Best Defense. He had an amazing case there. This guy came into a room to kill his roommate or something, and he shot him. It turned out later that the roommate was already, or the guy there was already dead. So he can't be charged for murder, obviously, but he was charged and convicted of attempted murder. So Dershowitz, the whole article there, and Dershowitz was arguing against this, is can you be charged with attempted murder if the person is already dead? Dershowitz's claim was you should be only be charged with assaulting a corpse or something like that. So it's a very interesting question. But that's the crazy case there with regard to this. Let me share with you something that I have yet to publish. It's one of the things on my list. It's been like 6 months since I've done a blog post, but I just sent it in today. So hopefully it won't be too long. Those old YU people, you'll be very interested in this blog post, which is coming up. But one of the things I want to speak about is another amazing passage. The famous text in Brachos, page 43b, speaks about different things which are unbecoming for a scholar. And one is scholar, Talmud Chacham. Don't converse with a woman in the street. Now, I think everyone who studies this passage understands that, okay, Talmidei Chachamim are held to a higher level. The average person, he can talk to the woman on the street, the Talmud, Chacham not. However, there's a great rabbi. We know him as the Shlus Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Reischer, one of the Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael of the 18th century. And he says something which, the sort of thing that they will censor if they reprint his Sefer and they, with a new typeset. He says that, no, it's not the way we usually think of that. He says that the passage is only directed against Talmid Chachamim so that people don't suspect the Talmud Chacham of being engaged, involved sexually with this woman. Why? Because he says that a Talmud Chacham has a greater Yetzer Hara than others. That's what the Gemara says. Now, I find the Shlus Yaakov's statement here quite jarring. We would have the exact opposite. Despite what the Gemara says, we would assume that Dafka, the average person, would be more inclined to carry on an affair, not a Talmud Chacham. But listen to what the Shlus Yaakov says. He says that those who explain that this really, it refers even more to the Hamonam, Sharam, the Yesh Chashta Yoser. But he says, with the MS Tau, but these people are wrong. The Dafka B'Talmud Chacham Huganai. He says, only with the Talmud Chacham it's a problem to speak to the woman. The Gam Mishum Chashta. The Chol HaGadol Mechaver Yitzhar Gadol Emedo. He says that, when we see an average person talking to the woman, we're not going to suspect anything, but we see the Talmud Chacham, we'll suspect it. I don't know. Any time if I would see a rabbi, that would be the last thing in my mind. But that's what he says. Okay, let us pick up where we left off. We finished up with the rabbinic conferences. I mentioned, incidentally, I had correspondence with one of you. I mentioned who conducted, it was a chaplain who's listening with us and conducted services in Worms at the synagogue there. And those who came with me to Germany, remember we went to the synagogue in Worms, Rashi Synagogue. I mentioned that sometimes in the small towns, the rabbis actually did go to the root of reform. The Rashi Synagogue, the famous, very old synagogue, which we're told that when Rashi came to Worms, that's where he was. But that became a reform synagogue. Many important synagogues became reform synagogues. So there's an example of this. What I want to do now is, let me ask you a few more things before we continue. Because we saw that at these conferences, they're getting rid of Jewish law, obviously. We spoke about Shabbos. We didn't really speak about Kashrus. If you look at the Jewish Encyclopedia, I noticed just this week that they have a very nice entry on rabbinic conferences, and they include more stuff. So, for example, it talks about how at the Breslau conference they deal with Shabbos also, how the importance of Shabbos, and that you shouldn't. They actually say you shouldn't violate biblical prohibitions because it's still Shabbos. But the rabbinic ones, and they say about Erev. And Erev is an evasion of the Sabbath law, which is now void because it's meaningless. But they also got rid of, as we spoke about, not just halachot, they got rid of minhagim. But we also got rid of minhagim. We've spoken about minhagim that we got rid of. So why is it problematic also that they would get rid of minhagim? Ritzvi Hirsch Chayes, actually, in his, if you look in his Kol Kisvei, volume 1, page 238, he says it's true we got rid of minhagim. He even mentions a couple. He says, for instance, in Poland and Russia, they don't say yotzros and biyutim. He says there's a difference, though. When things happen naturally, that's different than when you get a group and you pull them together and you decide you're going to reform Judaism. And as part of the reforms, you get rid of minhagim. Look, my shul got rid during COVID, got rid of the yitzen l'cha, and they're not bringing it back. So you could say that's a reform. Those of us who were in shul, you know, Hoshanas. When I was young, we always did Hoshanas, and this is the Ashkenazic minhag after Musaf. Now I've seen many shuls, they all seem to have changed it to the Sephardic way of doing, or the Hasidic way of doing it. I think the Ari held to do this way, to do it right after Hallel. But the reason we do it is because it's more convenient, and you don't have to put away the lulav, take it out again. But that's a reform. It's definitely a reform, but it's a reform with a small r. It doesn't. But if this was part of a whole movement where they stand up and they're changing Judaism, and then they get rid of all these things together with the halachic matters, then it becomes more problematic. It's like the old joke that I think it was maybe Shadal who said that we could compromise. So we'll get rid of Yikum Porkan. If that's the reform you want, we can compromise, get rid of Porkan, and that'll be that. But once it's part of a whole procedure to get rid of things, you can't do that. I told you about how in the Sephardic world, at least in most Sephardic shuls, they don't call people up by the name. They just say Rishon, Sheni, Shlishi, or Kohen, Levi, Yisroel, and then Revi, Chamishi. But this is one of the reforms that the reformers advocated in the first generation. We saw last semester, and the Orthodox are very opposed to it. But what's the big deal how you call them up? Because, as I said, it was part of a whole litany of things that they wanted to get rid of. Also, I think I wondered, if you recall in the earlier classes, why this was such a big deal. Why is it such a problem calling someone up by their name, Moshe Ben Yaakov? I saw that one author writes, I forgot to mention this, that it's because they were embarrassed of their Hebrew names, and that's why they didn't want to be called up by name. So when you look, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's really the reason why. I think it might have been that they were just, we spoke about this exaltation of the Sephardic world. If that's what the Sephardim do, then that's what we're going to do. One reform, which I think no one in my show is complaining about, is the Mishaberachs were very much streamlined. Already we had, before COVID, we got rid of individual Mishaberachs for sick people. Instead, it's one announcement, and although we divide men and women, which is interesting, but you insert it yourself. But even once that was put in, in many shuls, every person going up there, it's the person has grandchildren, so it's all the children, all the grandchildren. They go through all the names. It takes a long time, so we got rid of that. But so we've seen now the different rabbinic conferences. They focused on women's issues also. At least the last one. Here's something from the. Meyer mentions it at on page 140, that at the last conference, the Breslau conference, they put forth a proposal which they never voted on it, but it had wide support, which would declare that women can be counted in the minyan. So that was the direction they were going. But that was it. No more rabbinic conferences. Why no more rabbinic conferences? Well, Meyer, in response to modernity, he explains it on page 141 that they had set a new date, 1848, for the next conference. If you know your European history, you know what happens in 1848. That's the year of revolution. And all of a sudden, rabbinic conferences were the last things on people's mind. He also says that, and this is interesting, that with the revolutionary spirit, a gathering of rabbis seemed out of keeping with the democratic spirit of the moment. If you're going to have a gathering, it has to include lay people also. And the rabbis don't want to gather with the lay people because then what type of rabbinic gathering is it with the lay people? So you didn't have, for nearly a generation, you didn't have any more rabbinic conferences. When we finish with this, either today or next week, we're going to start dealing with what I want to do is a couple classes, just maybe two classes on the Hungarian response to reform, which most people don't know about. And then we're going to deal with a move into Rabbi Zalman Ber Bamberger, which is going to, I'm going to put that, the response of Orthodoxy to reform, I'm going to include in those talks. I can kill two birds with one stone. But before I get to that, I'll just share one more thing with you in terms of response, because it's worth noting. One of the responses was the creation of an Orthodox periodical literature. There was a German newspaper put up by Rav Yaakov Ettlinger of Altona, Sion's Vechter, but it also had a Hebrew section to it. And the Hebrew section is called Shomer Tzion HaNe'aman. And this is the faithful ones. That is the point. Although it's a Torah journal, it doesn't only respond to the Reform, but whenever there's something to deal with the Reform, they'll respond to it. And this is an important, people often say it's the first Torah periodical. As I pointed out already in the previous class, it's not. You had a Torah periodical in Amsterdam. I even showed you images from it. But this is the first Torah periodical in Germany. Yaakov Ettlinger, you can see we have classes on him on the Torah in Motion website. Torah in Motion is now putting my old classes from 10 years ago and more on as podcasts. So I'm getting emails from all these people. They don't even know about these Monday night classes, but they somehow came to the podcasts. So if you're interested, you can listen to that. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, to remind everyone, is the first posek to say you can count a non-Shomer Shabbos to a minyan. According to the Talmud, if you do violate Shabbos, it's if you you don't believe in God. And therefore, you're not part of the Kehillah. That was always the red line. But Rebecca Vettlinger says that today we see people, they can go to shul, and then after shul, they go to work. We know people the whole like this. The fact that Shomer Mechal Shabbos has nothing to do with their belief in God, and in many ways, they're very religious and spiritual. But for one reason or another, they work, or they feel they have to work, or they don't understand why there's a problem. When I say work, I don't mean necessarily going to work in a business. I mean doing malacha. The fact that they drive to shul on Shabbos shows that they're not the classic example that the Talmud speaks about of a Mechal Shabbos. So Rav Yaakov Ettlinger says that this is a new category. Is this a reform? It's not a reform. It's using the eternal principles and applying it to new circumstances where clearly the Talmud's description, and this was a description that really until the 19th century was a true description. Someone who would be Mechal Shabbos Parfahesia in public was obviously someone who's completely rejecting Judaism. But now we have a new phenomenon, and therefore you need a new approach. I also was reading today, this gets back to the, too bad Rabbi Kelman is not with us, but he will see this, I guess, when he listens to the tape. In the latest issue of Hamayan, it has a story there, someone who claims to be an eyewitness, where a rabbi who went to a town in Western Canada, where he made the minyan and everything, but lo and behold, in the winter, you couldn't daven unless you davened before Amud HaShachar, because everyone would leave. And the question was, could you daven with the people? And he turned it into like a cure of town. Could you daven before with a minyan before Amud HaShachar? And he quotes from Moshe Feinstein as saying that if you do not have this minyan before Amud HaShachar, that these people who have become religious will not have any davening, and you're going to lose them entirely. So Ramosha is a good old Yisrael. He could say there's a whole principle in the Talmud. Sometimes you can violate a small thing for the larger thing. And I'm presuming that saying these brachas before Amud HaShachar is maybe violating Bracha of Atola, perhaps. But Ramosha is able to make a decision that this is an entire kehillah. And if you say that for the next 4 months, we're not having a minyan during the week, then you're going to lose them entirely. We know that great rabbinic figures can make decisions like that. Okay, let's continue. So after these conferences, you have obviously the Orthodox, now called Orthodox. You have the Reform. It's now a Reform movement. It's not just individuals. Meyer actually, he concludes his chapter dealing with the second generation in Germany by saying that these conferences made it apparent that now you have a Reform movement. And things are now split. You now have the traditionalists, and you now have the Reform. The ideology formulated in the succeeding decades after the Hamburg Temple controversy enjoyed widespread support among a significant portion of the German rabbis. He says they were approaching the point by mid-19th century where the majority of German Jewry would be non-Orthodox. It's definitely in the big cities, but soon it'll be in many of the smaller towns as well. And then, so you have then, by the mid-19th century, really, you speak of two different movements. Now, how far rabbis can move their communities in the direction of reform often depended on the policies of the state they were in. So in many states did not like reform. They saw it as akin to revolution. Other states left it to the there wasn't one Germany. There was various states. Other states left it to the rabbi or the community. There was one state. I'll show it to you so you remember it. Sachsa Weimar, where, believe it or not, the government, for whatever reason, I don't know the details, decided that reform is something they want. Usually, governments didn't like reform. And the government ruled in the 1830s that the Jewish community has to pray in German. We know that it was basically ignored, but there were protests and the law was ignored. But in 1837, the government began to enforce the law. They would send people into the synagogue, government officials, to make sure that they prayed in German. And for 100 years, not sorry, for 10 years, the 1,400 Jews who lived in this state were forbidden to have public services in German. Now, I'm sure that the Orthodox gathered in people's homes and did it properly, but the main synagogues, few of them, by government rule, it became German prayers. Now, the job of the rabbi for the German government was to advance public morality and to preach law-abiding religiosity. That becomes a major factor for reform, and only later was then adopted by the Orthodox, namely sermons. Another point we said again and again, sermons, which are so vital to the modern Orthodox shul, which are so basic, you know they're coming as soon as the Torah is put back to the Ark. This is a reform innovation. Rabbanim would have drushas, but they wouldn't be during davening, and they wouldn't be the form of the sermon we have. The 10 or 15 minutes, which is supposed to be edifying and to raise the spirit, that comes directly from the churches, which then goes to Reform Judaism. Try to imagine what would happen if the rabbi gets up and says, this pasuk says X, Rashi comments on this pasuk something, but it's a problem because this what Rashi says seems to be contradicted by the Gemara, and then give the answer and sit down. People look at you like you're crazy. That's a sermon? And they'd be right, because that's not a sermon. A sermon is supposed to leave the people morally inspired. But that's not traditional. Hirsch was really the first one, Rachel Sherfel Hirsch, who adopted this. And it now has become standard, so much so that we judge our rabbis often, and whether we keep them or we hire them, not by if they know Shas and Poskim, not if they could give a good shiur, but how well they speak. I mean, the conservative shuls, the rabbis spend the whole summer preparing for their sermons on the high holidays. But we also, it's such a big deal. And look, we need it. I mean, and we've had great sermonizers. You look at Rabbi Lamb's sermons, Rabbi Jung, others. I mean, Lukstein, they became masters in this. But we need to be honest that this is not what we're part of the traditional East European. Those of you who've been with me to Budapest, when we go into the old Kaczynski shul, we'll talk about what Hungarian Orthodoxy is like in a couple of classes and its response to reform. But everything there remains the way it was from the mid-19th century, which means no sermons. So what do? During Kiddush, the Rav will give a little Dvar Torah, but no sermons. Okay, so let me continue. The question of what to deal with the reform, like I said, we'll get back to. Since I just mentioned Rebecca Vettlinger, let me just briefly note that Rebecca Vettlinger got in a major dispute with other Gedolim, including Rav Shlomo Eger, the great Rabbi Akiva Eger, father of the Chasam Sofer, had a son, Rav Shlomo Eger. Rav Shlomo Eger is also a great Talmud Chacham, not at the level of his father, Rabbi Akiva Eger. Sometimes the sons are greater than the father. Sometimes the fathers are greater than the sons. I haven't really heard that much about Rav Shlomo Eger and his relationship with his father, but that's why at the funeral of Rav Soloveitchik, I was a little surprised, and I assume that it's correct. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik has this by tradition. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was talking about the relationship that his brother, Rav Joseph B., the Rav, had with his father. And he said, I was not zocha to such a relationship, Rav Aaron says, but my brother and his father, and you know, Rav Moshe and Rav Yosef Dov had a very special, unique relationship. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said, the only example we have of such a relationship of father and son, this is my recollection, he says, Rav Akiva Eger and Rav Shlomo Eger. I don't know why, not the Chasam Sofer and his son, but that's what he said. But Rav Shlomo Eger said that the Orthodox should put all the reform under Chevron. And if you recall, that's what we saw already 20 weeks ago. Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, says, if we could, if the governments allowed us, because chayrim was forbidden by the government, we would declare that all the reform are like the carrots, and we can't intermarry with them. But you couldn't do this by the now the mid-19th century, because there are too many of them, and you're just going to wipe your hands. And it's one thing when the reform are a minority and they're a sectarian group, but now they're the majority, certainly in the big cities. So you can't just get rid of them. So Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, and also of Nathan Adler, Nathan Marcus Adler, who would then become Chief Rabbi of London. At this time, he was in Hanover. He says that, no, this is not the approach today. Rav Shlomo Eger says that Rav Yaakov Ettlinger is afraid of losing the battle if he goes to war against the reformers. But that's not it. It's that he recognized, just like he said that the Mechal Shabbos today, you don't treat them like a non-Jew. He says, these reformers, you can't treat them like non-Jews because most of the reformers, they don't know anything. They hear what the rabbi says, so they go along. A book came out just 2 months ago. Here it is. It's called Masechet Tmurot. And it's a biography of Rav Mordechai Shmuel Girondi. He was the Rav of Padua. At the same time that Shmuel David Tzato was in Padua. Shmuel David Tzato Shadal was not the rabbi. He died young in his 50s. He corresponded with all the Gedolim. There's thousands of pages at the seminary and in London in manuscript of tshuvot and discussions. And this is a book, really. It's dealing with the decline of Italian Jewry through the 19th century from a Torah perspective. But I found something interesting, which reflects also the same approach of Yaakov Ettlinger. And on page 210, he quotes from a manuscript letter where he says that the German rabbis who are so strong against Geiger, they're making a mistake. Now, Ettlinger was strong against Geiger. He just didn't want to read out of the fold the masses. But speaking from the Italian perspective, Rav Girondi says, this is not how you deal with people like Geiger. He says to them, you have to approach them me'ahava, from love. And he says, what does me'ahava stand for? Machnifin et harasha'im ba'olam hazeh. That is, when you have Rishayim with power, you have to kiss up to them, you have to make nice to them, because you accomplish more with honey than with vinegar. But I want to tell you about a great dispute now that took place in Breslau, where the conference was. Took place the decade before. And it took place between the Orthodox and Reform. Geiger was front and center. It's not only an intellectual dispute, but it's a dispute that was on the ground and split communities. And this is what happened with Geiger in Breslau. The Rav of Breslau, there was an old-fashioned Talmud Chacham. His name was Tikton. Rav Shlomo, I say Shlomo, but it's written his German. It was Solomon, so in German, so in Hebrew, they write Zalman. Avraham Tikton, traditional old-fashioned Rav. And he had no interest in any sort of modernization, so much so that the community, now this was right now a traditionalist community with the synagogue, which was a traditional synagogue, but the people wanted something new. So they made and they were his employer. They said that from now on, once a month, he has to preach on religious and moral subjects. That is, he has to give a sermon. Rav Tikton, what does Rav Tikton know? He can give a shiur. You want to hear a shiur on halacha? He'll give a shiur. But and when I say people listening, you know probably that there were people who gave sermons, magidim, who gave preachers. But take a look at the drushas of the Talmidei Chachamim. They're like drushas full of Talmudic learning. And so, yes, you had magidim who would come in. But the magids also, it's not they would preach Musar, but it's not the sermon we think about. So Rav Tikton ignored the fact that the community said that you are obligated to preach to us once a month. It's amazing. The community requires it. They want to be preached to. It's like it says in the... if you look in the books of the prophets, I think in particular Yeshayahu, it says that the people would follow after the prophet. Now, why would they follow after the prophet? All the prophet did was scream at them how bad they were. But I guess that was a form of entertainment, maybe, to listen to the prophets, the way they would scream at them. So whether they really wanted the Musar or whether they just thought it would break up the monotony of davening, Rabbi Tikton was told, you must preach to us once a month, and he refused to. So what to do then? They decided in 1838 to hire an assistant rabbi. If Rabbi Tikton is not going to give a sermon, we'll hire an assistant rabbi. The same thing happened, incidentally, in New York, at where in KJ, they wanted a rabbi to preach in English. So they have to get Mordechai Kaplan to come preach in English because the old-fashioned rabbi can't do that. The Ramaz and the Ritbaz was actually Yaakov Dobrolovsky was in New York when Kaplan preached, and he was outraged by it. The Ritbaz says, as I've repeated so many times, if you're in a synagogue where a rabbi gets up to preach in the vernacular, walk out. And I told you, my friend in Hollywood, Florida, he always leaves for the sermon and he tells people, I hold like the Ritbaz. If you're not going to preach in Yiddish, then I don't need to stay here. But in 1838, there was about 6,000 Jews in Breslau. It's a big community. But 120 members, I guess important members, petitioned the officers of the community that they want a new rabbi, an assistant rabbi, one who's going to preach, a modern rabbi. So you have Rabbi Tikhtin, he's the old-fashioned rabbi, and then you're going to have the more modern rabbi. He would serve on the Beis Din, and he would also deliver sermons. So who does the board pick? They pick Geiger. So imagine the scene now. Geiger, the Reform rabbi, is picked to be the assistant rabbi to Tikhtin, and not only that, to serve on the same Beis Din. So thus begins a clash which would have great symbolism. From the standpoint of the Balabatim, what's the difference? You know, Geiger will preach and the halacha will be decided by Tikhtin. But why can't you have the Reform rabbi? The Reform rabbi was not supposed to be in charge of halacha. That they left to Tikhtin. So you're going to say now the Reform rabbi is in the Beis Din? How could you have a Reform rabbi in the Beis Din? Geiger had an answer to this. He says that, and I think the lawyers listening to also appreciate this. He said that you can be a judge. We know that every judge in America is obligated to enforce the law. Now, they might not agree with the law, and they might be hoping that the Supreme Court's going to change it. But as long as it's not changed, they have to enforce it. So Geiger said, I don't believe in these laws, but since I was appointed to the Beis Din, I will enforce these laws. So he doesn't believe in Gittin, let's say. But since the community requires a get, he'll make sure that a proper get is written. If you're a secular lawyer, that makes sense. But it doesn't make sense for a Torah Jew. You can't have a Beis Din where one of the people doesn't believe in it. But that's he was appointed. So Tikhtin represents old-style traditionalism, and Geiger represents modernity. We will see later there's going to be a new type of modernity, an Orthodox modernity, but that's when we get to Shom Sharaf Hirsch. We're not there yet. Right now, you have a choice. You're traditional, old-fashioned, or you're modern. You can't be, and then you're not observant. You're not Orthodox. You can't be Orthodox and be modern. It's Hirsch who's going to come on the scene and say this is a false choice, that you can be traditional, that is observance of observe halacha, but you can also be modern. But that did not exist at this time. And in fact, the Reform argument was that Jews of Germany, you have a choice. You can be modern like me, Geiger, and the rest of us, and you can go to the university and have everything that this modern enlightened German state offers, or you could be like this old-fashioned Rabbi Tikhtin. Now, the traditionalists in Breslau were able to postpone Breslau's arrival, Geiger's arrival in Breslau, because they appealed to the Prussian government. But we're already, by the mid-19th century, the government doesn't want to get involved in religious disputes anymore, and the government permits him to get Prussian citizenship. Without Prussian citizenship, he couldn't come be the assistant rabbi, and the traditionalists were preventing this, but eventually the government said enough, and they permitted him. So as soon as Geiger comes to town, now Geiger starts going to the main synagogue, assuming his place as assistant rabbi. I don't know what the synagogue looked like, but you can imagine the scene. Tikhtin on one side of the Aron Kodesh and Geiger on the other. So Tikhtin leaves. He says, I will not daven in the same shul as Geiger. So basically, he's giving up the shul without a fight. But he goes to another shul, and he refuses to serve on the Beis Din with Geiger. So the Beis Din stops meeting, because Tikhtin says, how can I serve on a Beis Din with this heretic? He actually, I guess because the difficult circumstances, we're told that Tikhtin was willing to compromise that allow Geiger to preach on moral subjects, something that later, of course, they never would allow. But if you're stuck in a circumstance like this, where it's a choice between maybe Geiger's going to take over everything, or you can make a compromise that it'll just let him preach on moral subjects, because even a reform rabbi could preach about, how to be a good person, moral, just keep away from halachic matters, like what they tried to do with the seminary. They tried to keep Mordechai Kaplan, keep him teaching Midrash. As long as he teaches Midrash, then they're not going to have a problem. And that was the argument, the Finkelstein, that we believe in freedom of expression here, and we'll keep Kaplan teaching Midrash. He can't cause any trouble there, and he can do actually good things. Geiger, Tipton actually said, he went so far as to say that Geiger, forget about, he said all the his heresies, Geiger is unfit to serve as a Rav in Breslau. The very fact that he went to the University of Bonn, means he's unfit. That is, from Tipton's perspective, any rabbi who attends a university is ipso facto invalid, which is a position I'm sure that even today you'll find certain people who argue. But Rav Yaakov Ettlinger went to the university, Nathan Nussan Marcus Adler, he went to the university. Obviously, this was then becoming popular. So what did you do then if there's no Basin? If you're in Breslau, you had to go to another city to get a get. Matters come to a head in Breslau. We have descriptions of this in the newspapers of the time. 1842, one of the prominent members of the community dies. And both at the funeral, both Tipton and Geiger were supposed to speak. They were asked to speak. Tipton as the Rav of the community, and Geiger, either the community asked him or the family, whatever it was. So Tipton, and we have a description of this. Tipton gives his drasha at the hesped, whatever it is, at the funeral. And in his talk, he makes derogatory allusions to Geiger. We don't know the exact details, but everyone knew that he was speaking negatively about Geiger. Then it's Geiger's turn to speak. And we know that as soon as Geiger gets up to speak, Tipton's supporters begin shouting at Geiger. You can imagine what they're saying. You're not a real rabbi. Get down, heretic. Whatever it is, they weren't letting him speak. And a fist fight takes place at the cemetery, which had to be broken up by the police. That's how we have reports in the newspapers that the police were called to break up a fight between the traditionalists and Geiger's supporters. Well, the community council, that is the community board, suspends Tipton because it's his responsibility. It's his people, and he caused this ruckus. But the government actually said that, no, you can't do that. He's the official rabbi. Remember, the rabbi is recognized by the government. So Tipton was put back, and he died shortly after that. Who succeeds him? In a sort of like unofficial, I think it's an unofficial, not official role, but I haven't been able to determine whether he was actually appointed by the community or only the Orthodox members. He had a son, Rav Gedalia Tipton. Rav Gedalia Tipton succeeds him. And now you have two rabbis serving. You have Rav Gedalia Tipton serving his community of traditionalists, and you have Geiger serving his community. And this is the model that would exist throughout Germany until World War II. We'll speak about it, where it became actually first just like we saw in Breslau, and then it became officially enshrined by the government of two separate communities, the Reform community and the Orthodox community. And in the Reform community, or the general community, they call it the Reform community. It's dominated by Reform often, but within this Reform dominated community, we will see that there was often, in fact, usually, an Orthodox community as well. And that's going to lead us to the great dispute we'll speak about soon in a few classes between Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch and Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger. Geiger would then, after this, he leaves Breslau. He goes to Frankfurt and Berlin. He dies in Berlin. I want to share with you now a story, which I found. Where is it? Which no one knows about this. So I'll share it with you now, and for all the listeners, for all the people who are on with us, there are 70. There's got to be four or five times as many who listen later. Well, I know on YouTube, there's always a few hundred within a week or two, but also just listen on the website. So you can spread this. I'm not going to be writing about it as far as I know. Sometimes I have things which I don't want to share because I want to write about it and let people wait till it comes out. But this, I'm not. I don't plan on writing about it. So anyone who wants to do something with it, feel free. There was a rabbi. His name was Rav Yisachar Tamar. Here he is. He died in Israel in 1982. He's from Poland, but he served as rabbi, and it says it here, for a number of years in the 30s in Breslau. Sorry, no, I'm wrong with that. I'm just reading it right now. He was up to 1920. He was in Breslau, and then he went to England. And it says that Rabbi Leo Young invited him there, then he returns in 1922, and only to Breslau in 1933 he goes to Eretz Yisrael. He's known. He's not a household name at all, but he's known because he wrote a multi-volume collection on the Yerushalmi. Where is the sefer? I don't see at the bottom. No, sometimes I have a picture of the sefer. It's called Alei Tamar. It's a great commentary on the Yerushalmi. And it's the sort of thing where if you just take it and you skim through the pages, every other page or so, you'll come across some crazy story or he throws everything into it. Now, it's on Otzar HaChma, so in theory, I could read it. But I don't want to. I want to have a copy. I want to hold it. I want Shabbos afternoon to page through it. I have looked and looked, and I cannot find it. His library is in Yeshivat Har Etzion. I was in Har Etzion for the first time in many years when I took my son there a couple of years ago to look at yeshivas. And you see, it has his library there. And I looked through some of the Sfarim to see if there was, sometimes they have handwritten comments on it. But the Sefer, Alei Tamar, if anyone listening knows where I can get a copy, I looked online. I can't seem to be able to copy. I don't need to get the whole set. I think it's like six volumes. I don't need to wonder. I'll tell you right now how many volumes, because I have my Otzar HaChma on my screen. Seven volumes. So I'll take any volume. I just want it. But let me share with you something that I found just in one of the times I was scrolling through it. When I say scrolling through it, though, I mean this is just al regalachas. What I want to do is I want to have the sefer in front of me so I can actually go through everything. And it relates to Breslau. In his commentary, volume 2, his commentary on Maseches Ma'aser Sheni of the Yerushalmi, page 174. You would never imagine you'd find this in the middle of a commentary Yerushalmi on Ma'aser Sheni. But here's the story. Now, and the story, there's a connection there because it has to do with leprosy on buildings. I don't need to get into details. But he says as follows. After going through the sugya, he says, I'm going to tell you about what I received, Mashikibalti, what I was told from the religious Jews in Breslau when I was the rabbi there. He says, this is where the Gaon, Rav Zalman Tikhtin, fought Milchamot Hashem in Ocher HaUma Avram Geiger, Avi Reforma. This is where Tikhtin fought against this, that's the phrase the prophet uses, Eliyahu, troubler, you know, Achav uses it about Eliyahu, right? Troubler of Israel, but to have the evil Geiger in Breslau. So what does he say? This is what Rabbi Tamar was told when he went to Breslau to serve as the Rav there, that before his death, he told his son, Rav Gedalia, don't stand in the synagogue where Geiger stood. That is, they were davening in a separate place, but even if we're able to force Geiger out, or if he leaves, and you, the Orthodox, can return to the main synagogue, do not stand where Geiger stood. And the story goes on. It says, after some years, when the reform, with the leadership of Geiger, Banu Lahem Temple Reformi, they built a reform temple. So what did they do? Avar Besak Nesas Agodosh, Ayasham Geiger, Mispalam Shomei Torah. So the old synagogue, since the reformers now built themselves a new temple, the original synagogue went, now the Orthodox can return and daven there. But now you have a problem, because Rabbi Tikhtin was told by his father not to stand in the place that Geiger stood in. And that's, he explains that. So Rabbi Tikhtin, what's he supposed to do now? So then what they did is they took out the stone and the dirt, digging down, Omek Yadua, where the rabbi would stand or sit, they broke this stone there, Chaltzu Avanim, they took the dirt out, threw it out, and then they took new stones and new dirt and rebuilt that place. You can imagine the, I don't know, 5x5, whatever they did. And then only when they redid the floor, did Amar HaMakom Karab Beis HaKnesses, did Rabbi Tikhtin stand and serve as Rav in that shul. And then he says it could be that Rav Zalman Tikhtin derived it from the sugya here of Avanim Menuga'ot, this, I guess, leprosy with the stones, the various halachas that have to do with it. And then he says that, and it's a good analogy because the stones and the dirt, where Geiger stood as a Reform rabbi, Hayu Menuga'ot B'Kfirav Apikorsut. They were infected with kfir, and the very stones that he stood upon had this. And the hayadinan kedin avanim va'afar menugaim. They have to be treated just like, leprous stones. And then he adds one more thing. He says, and there's a practical implication here. What happens if a shul buys a church? A shul can buy a church. If the church decides to sell the church to a shul, you can do that. And we have examples of this. What I can tell you now, as far as I know, I know a couple, including the shul that West Orange, New Jersey, the original one was a church. And there's a shul in London, a big shul in Hendon, used to be a church. As far as I know, no one ever thought of this idea. No one followed this. But this is what he says. Based on the same principle, in the place that they had the tzelem, the cross, Omakom Shama Sham Komer, or where you know the priest would stand, he says you should take out the dirt there and the stones and put in new dirt and stones. Okay, ask your local rabbi next time you're buying a church for your soul if you need to do that. As far as I know, from what I've seen, I've never actually been there for a service, but I went to the church. I guess the priests stand in one place, but it's not like our rabbis, is it? Where they have like a place where they sit and they stand. They sort of stand in the front and give their sermon. Okay, so there. But our place, we're not going to give the sermon there because we turn it around. But as far as I know, the priest or the preacher, it's not like our shul where they have a place, a makom kavua, where they stand. But I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong. Okay, let me take some comments and questions here. And Natan Khan says, Brandeis magazine recently had an article touting intermarriage as a way of expanding the Jewish tent. There have been people who've also said that, and they're right about this, that it actually helps with anti-Semitism. Because if you have a Jewish, if your brother-in-law is Jewish, you're less inclined to be anti-Semitic. But it is amazing. My father, in his book on American Judaism after World War II, called A Time for Healing, he speaks about how, in the 70s, there was a television show, Bridget and Bernie, and there was protest by leading Jewish organizations because it portrayed an intermarried couple. By the 1980s, it was unimaginable that anyone would raise objections, and 30-something, which is a popular show as well, had an intermarried group, and no one would. And obviously today, those of us who live in the New York area, Lee Zeldin, he's intermarried, he's married to a Mormon. And the Frum community is going to be voting for him, like other than Satmar, which is getting some goodies from the current governor. So they'll vote wherever they get the money. Zeldin has been touring all the Frum neighborhoods, and he's going to get like 95 to 99% of the vote. In the Black Hat, probably 100%. And he's intermarried. No one's even raising the issue anymore. We know we've lost that battle. What are you going to do? We've lost that battle on intermarriage. And even in the most Frum, you have questions now. Can you, and your son is with a non, is married to a non-Jew, or your daughter is married to a non-Jew. So the grandchildren are Jewish. Can you invite them to the Passover Seder? What you do? Even Rav Mazuz in Israel, and in Israel you don't have this phenomenon, but he's getting questions from France. He writes in his book on Pesach about, he says that you can invite relatives of yours who are intermarried. I mean, the time that we cut them off, that just, it doesn't work anymore, and it's not applicable. So I understand why, Brent, but, from our perspective, it's an unfortunate thing, but it's a reality we have to live with. But then to turn it we're never going to reach the point in our circles where this is actually a positive. Really, that's what America's all about, isn't it? The different groups come together, and I teach my classes. I teach a class in world religions, and we get to Judaism. We deal with Ezra, and I have him write an essay on interfaith marriage, which used to be for Christians also used to be a no-no. It is almost impossible to find anyone today who sees a problem with intermarriage. And many of the students think it's like a racist sort of thing when I say that traditional Judaism is opposed to intermarriage. After I explain the whole history of it and how, you know, what it's about, and just practically, if both partners are not Jewish, how you can't run a Jewish home, it's just impossible. And I show them pictures of some weddings where you see in most of our shuls, you have people of all different colors and everything. So there's no racial element at all, but I understand if you're not raised in our circles with our tradition, the idea that in America in the 21st century that there'd be a problem with marrying outside your group. And you know, let me say something which also might be radical and heretical. If you're not a Torah observant Jew, if Torah is not important to you, then why shouldn't you not intermarry? There's no reason not to. This is America. Everyone should be together with everyone. We have nothing to say to people who are not Torah observant, really, why you shouldn't intermarry. You could send them birthright and maybe they'll come back and be influenced. But really, I mean, maybe you have an answer. I don't have an answer. If you're not a Torah Jew, it's not today in America. What can you say to the people? And it's worse in other countries, and that's in America. Eric says, the second time, we'll get rid of the second Yom Kippur. Okay. Rabbi Shudnow. Oh, thank you, Rabbi Shudnow, for joining us. I missed you a few classes. As a Navy chaplain attending a conference, I sat in the seat of Rashi in the Rashi Synagogue in Worms. Well, as I said, we have someone with us, another chaplain who you probably know if you look through the names, because you served as chaplains together, although you were in the Navy, I believe, correct? He was Army. He can tell us he conducted services there. I don't know if we know, by the way, was Rashi there? What's the whole, but that's the tradition. In fact, when you go to the synagogue, you have the wall where Rashi's mother, apparently when the horseman was riding, she was going to be killed. She pulled up against the wall and the wall opened up for her a little bit. And that's why there's this opening in the wall that she was able to save herself. And it's right there. Everyone goes and you see it miraculously. Now, the problem with all these stories, with this story, is that as far as I know, as far as anyone knows, Rashi didn't grow up in Worms. So what would his mother be doing pregnant with Rashi, carrying him around in Worms? So I don't know, but I'm going to... I just looked online. I was curious to see it. So there is a legend, I see, that his parents moved to Worms. Okay, whatever. Mark says, oh, there you go. Yeah, the reform was getting rid of the second Yom Kippur. Yes, okay, you're right. Mel, I know podcasts. Yes, the right now, they are actual podcasts, not what you have on the website where they call it a podcast. I understand it's not really a podcast. You get it sent to you. You go on Spotify, plug in. They gave it an interesting title. They called it Uncensored. What do they call it? Jewish History Uncensored with Mark Shapiro. There's another podcast. The guy emailed me, also called Jewish History Uncensored. So, but I don't know who was first. So it's Jewish History Uncensored, and they don't need to be downloaded. It's a regular podcast. They even have a guy with a good voice at the beginning, giving an introduction. Very nice.
About time. Thank you.
It's been probably because of you telling me, and I pushed on this. Rabbi Shudno said the Shabbos Adon and Shabbos Shuva were the times where rabbis were preaching. That's when they had to preach. But rabbis preached at other times as well. Look at the drashos of the Noda Bihud and all the other gedolim. They had to preach on those times, but they preached other times as well. They preached if a guy gave a lot of tzedakah, if an important person died. They preached on all sorts of occasions. If there's a plague, they preached. They did preach on other occasions, but generally you had Megidim, whose job it was to preach. Reb Chaim, by the way, Reb Chaim Brisker, he never even preached on maybe the first couple of years he did, but after that he didn't, and Reb Elvel didn't either on Shabbos Agadol and Shabbos Shuva. I take that back about Reb Elvel. I know Reb Chaim didn't. I don't know Revelver. I don't think he did either, but I know for a fact Reb Chaim did it because Reb Galevsky told me, and I've seen it in other places as well. So this is an interesting point here. You have Reb Chaim. He's the Rav of your community. He doesn't give a shiur to the community. In those days, he didn't give shiur to the community. He doesn't speak to the community. He doesn't give preach to the community. Why? What are you paying for? You're paying for a rabbi. He doesn't give classes to the community. He doesn't paskin. Reb Chaim didn't paskin. For that, you have Reb Simcha Zelig and other dayanim. So here you have a rabbi. He doesn't decide all the questions. He doesn't preach to the community. He doesn't teach. Why would you pay him? What would you do? But you know what Reb Chaim says the job of a rabbi is? That's not the job of a rabbi. You want someone to paskin challenge, you can hire someone. You want someone to preach, hire. The job of the rabbi is to take care of the community and take care of the least fortunate ones. Reb Chaim would take care of the widows and the orphans and make sure that everyone was taken care of. Today, we would say that's the job of a social worker. A typical rabbi, many rabbis, they don't want to be involved with that. That's not what they want, to give shiurim and do things. And for Reb Chaim, it's pum fakir, it's just the opposite. Other people give shiurim. You want to give shiurim, they can hire you as the magid shiur. But as a job of a rabbi, it's your job to go visit the sick people and go take care of them. And also, well, there's something else. The community, they can bask in the glory that they have such a talmid chacham like Reb Chaim. Very different today what people is expected for the rabbi. Charles says the Shomayer was attracted and adopted some Hasidic questions, much to the dismay of his father. Indeed, and there's the old Hasidic joke that in heaven his father will. They say it about a number of figures. The joke is as follows: the story that the father on his deathbed commands his son, "Don't say in Kaddish, don't say V'yasmach Korkane." That's the Hasidic edition. Don't say it. And after he dies, so you ask the Rav, the Hasidic Rav, yes, well, can I say it? My father commanded me not to. And the answer they always give is, now your father's in heaven. He knows the truth that you should say it. So therefore, he's mochel on what he told you. So they say that about Rav Shlomo Eger. How can Rav Shlomo Eger go against his father? Well, because ex post facto, now the diavad, his father's in heaven. His father sees that the Hasidic approach is the correct approach. So he doesn't have any issues. It's actually the grandson, isn't it? Really, Rav Label Eger, I believe, who really became a Hasidic person. The book about Italian Jewry, it's called Masechet Zmurot. The whole thing is available online as well, as far I believe, by Moshe Hillel. This is a Haredi guy. He's the son of the Mekubal in Israel, Yaakov Moshe Hillel, who comes from India. You can see him online, Yaakov Moshe Hillel, in English Shirim and Hebrew Shirim. It's a very interesting story, Yaakov Moshe Hillel. It comes from like a Baghdadi family, not that observant, but they sent him to Gateshead and during the 50s or 60s, and he became a big Talmud Chacham, and he's a well-known Makuba. Well, his son has become like something of an academic scholar, really. He has his hands on everything, and it's a very nice book. Rabbi Shudnow says, how about Rabbi Ben Amozig in Livorno? I sat in his seat as well and held one of his manuscripts. He died in 1920. Well, I have to tell you, Rabbi Shudnow, you couldn't have sat in Rabbi Ben Amozig's seat because the synagogue you sat in was the synagogue they rebuilt after World War II. The synagogue was destroyed in the war by bombings. So they rebuilt that brand new synagogue, which some people love and other people hate. So that was not his actual chair. By the way, and furthermore, he was not the Rav of the community. A lot of people think that he never was the Rav, although he's a great Talmud Chacham. And yes, they do have manuscripts of his. We had classes on Rabbi before we knew each other, Rabbi Shudnow. You can see it on the website. We have classes. I gave classes on Rabbi Ben Amozig. Actually, I say it in Ashkenazi, Ben Amozig. His name is Ben Amozig, Rabbi Ben Amozig. Yes, and Eric says JTS at Kaplan teaching rhetoric, how to give a good sermon. He's good for that. Yes, and Mel reminds us that the presence of Kaplan on the JTS faculty made the merger impossible. I did not ask Nachi Weinstein about Alei Tamar. Maybe I should ask him. Yes, and Mel says the majority of Jews think it's racist to be opposed to intermarriage. Because if you explain it to them that in a different way, that it's a religious thing and that race has nothing to do with it, then I can see the students basically all come to terms with it, that it's a religious thing and you can't really practice Judaism unless both people do it. So they get it. But most people, if you don't explain to them, they think it's an ethnic thing. Lazerson says Birthright accepts those who only have Jewish fathers, and following protests ended all discussions about the importance of Jews marrying Jews. What are they going to do? The federations also had to stop it because you have lots of leaders of federation whose children are intermarried, and now you have leaders of federation who themselves are not halachic Jews because they're patrilineal. You have leading reform rabbis who are not halachic Jews. That's why I said that we need a new category, perhaps. I spoke about this category of the God-fearers. Josephus speaks about these people in Second Temple times, who were not willing to convert. In fact, Nero's wife was one of them. They were fed up with Roman religion. They wanted some meaning to their life, and they found it in like a quasi-Judaism. They weren't ready to convert entirely either because of Bris Milah, or they didn't want to take everything on, but they were called God-fearers. So these people, we can't just consider them like non-Jews. And we want them on our side. We want them supportive of Israel, but they're not Jewish, halachically. So I think this category maybe of a God-fearer, it's not my idea. I once spoke about these God-fearers and a big macher in Federation. Many of you would know the name if I said it, but I don't know if he wants me to. He says I should come speak at a Federation gathering about this, which is impossible because that would be very offensive to the people there. But from us, I think to create a category of people who feel Jewish, who desire the best for the Jewish people, they're just not halachically Jewish. My daughter was involved in a Federation event and in my local Federation, New Jersey, and then they took them all to Israel. So they had an event. Her roommate, she calls me up. Her roommate's not Jewish. Her roommate's patrilineal. But that's every college rabbi, Orthodox rabbi, when they do a wedding, knows that you have to look into the yichus, because a lot of the people going to Chabad, for instance, are not halachically Jewish. And this is why I got very annoyed at a certain Chabad house that will remain nameless, because I'm at this Chabad house and they have good wine there. You know, the Chabad houses, they need their wine and the liquor to keep the kids there. But I'm looking at the wine bottle, and the wine bottle is not mavushal. So there's nothing wrong with not mavushal wine. You can get it at any good wine store, but you can't serve it at a Chabad house. The reason you can't serve it as a Chabad house is because lots of the people at the Chabad house are not halachically Jewish. Not to mention the fact that you have non-Jews coming anyway because they hear it's a good evening. I know this for a fact because I was at the Princeton Chabad house where my daughter is, and the non-Jews were coming because they think the food and the atmosphere is interesting. But even at a Chabad house that only has Jews, you have a good number of Jews there that are not halachically Jewish. So I thought I would say something to the rabbi, but I made a mistake. I didn't say it because I didn't want to offend him. And but now in retrospect, I should have said something to him that how could he do this? That they're going to have any Chabad house in the world. You will have, my experience, non-halachic Jews, even people from Israel. You have people from Israel now that have a Russian mother, let's say. Yeah, they're not so. Yes, there is the Russian worms. Okay. Okay, and yes, Rabbi Shem, now the Allies blew up the original synagogue. That's correct. I went to Italy last summer, so I'm not going back to Italy this summer. But those who've been with Italy the last couple of years know we don't go to Livorno. But I used to take them to Livorno. The problem is that two kosher wineries opened up, one near Pisa and one near Siena. And the second or third time I took the group to Livorno, there were some people who saw signs for this kosher winery in the kosher restaurant in Florence, and they said, why don't we go to the winery? And of course I said, well, we've already have the arrangements. But the next time we did it, we started going to the winery, and now the wineries serve lunch there, at least with the one near Pisa. And my experience is that even though my group is a group of intellectuals and they want to see hear all about the great events of Jewish history, I have to sometimes accept the facts that most people, and I did a sort of vote on the bus, most people want to go to the winery instead of going to see another show, even a show as beautiful as Livorno. So now if you come on my trip, we will go to the winery and have lunch there. And with that, I see it's we've gone on long enough. So thank you all. And I'll see you, God willing, next week. And good night.